Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning, for those of you in the hall and for most of you who are online. So what I want to talk about this morning, a week ago we had a 5-day Wisdom Path retreat. And so I want to talk a little bit about, just a little bit about a Wisdom Path retreat, and then share some of the kind of key teachings with the whole Sangha. And then I've invited 4 members who are on the retreat, 3 who are in the hall, 1 that's online, to share briefly their experience of being on this retreat, what was most significant or meaningful to them, and maybe how a wisdom retreat compares to Dharma Path retreat, Mindful Living Path retreats that they've been on. So I think, as all as you know, in our community, we sort of have three paths that are sort of a developmental model. And people enter at various levels, but always it's you build on. It's not as if you no longer do when you get to the next. You build on all the learning and experience that you've already accomplished. So the first thing is, when we enter our community, we want to establish some degree of stability, and that involves learning to be mindful, which means learning to be present, which is something in our culture is not easy. We spend a lot of our time in distraction, lost in many ways. So learning to be present, learning to be there's a present reality, and learning that one can be present to it. And that doesn't just mean drinking tea or brushing our teeth. That means, with all the experiences of our life, our relationships, people, our work, we are no longer lost in the past and the future. We are learning how to be present, at least to some degree. So there's stability. The other part of that is emotional healing. Because as long as our mind is continually roiled about by reactive emotional states, it's very hard to be stable and to develop any kind of meditative stability. So that's the first path. The second path is a Dharma path. Builds on that. What is the Dharma path? It's taking advantage of the wisdom, so to speak, intelligence of this Buddhist tradition, 2,600 years, where people have learned about and studied the human experience, the human mind, how it operates, how it works, what contributes to a well-functioning mind, what contributes to a dysfunctional mind, right? What contributes to positive, wholesome mind states? What contributes to unwholesome, afflictive mind states? And really understanding the dynamics of this life in terms of this perspective that has been developed. And that's a Dharma path. And if people have successfully, to some degree, wholeheartedly entered into the mindful living path, some degree in the Dharma path, people's lives will change. There'll be greater stability, there'll be greater clarity, better experience of wholesome mind states, and life should generally, even our worldly life, so to speak, which is, we all live in the world, should get better. It should feel better to be us, and our relationships with the world, should be of a higher quality and experience. We should be calmer. We should be more peaceful. We should be more open. We should be more just to be present to all the people and experiences of our life. So that's, in a nutshell, many, many teachings, and many things we do, but that's, and in the mindful living path, and in the Dharma path, in a certain sense, we're doing a lot. We're learning a lot. We're learning a lot of different practices. We're learning a lot of things to change our mind and heal and transform ourselves So there's a lot to learn, and there's sort of there's a lot to do. Okay? And the Dharma path and the mindfulness path are based on this path that goes back to Shakyamuni Buddha, this path of transformation, healing and transformation. You know, so it's all the practices that we learn and all the teachings we study are based on this path that we're walking and that the Buddha taught for nearly 50 years. The wisdom path is very different because it's based on the Buddha's enlightenment. Before he taught for 50 years, it all comes from he had this great enlightenment, this great inner transformative experience, which changed the whole way he viewed himself in life, etc. Okay? And so that enlightenment experience and what that revealed to him is the basis of the wisdom path, right? And the, we might say the goal, we speak of a goal in the wisdom path, is for us to have, to some degree, an experience of our own mind that is somewhat in the ballpark of what the Buddha experienced. Okay, so, in the wisdom path, there is less to do, there's less doing, and there's more looking into the mind itself. We are now mining our own wisdom. Okay? Because the fundamental teaching of the Buddha at the wisdom level is everything is arising in mind. All thoughts, all feelings, all perceptions, all dramas, all everything wholesome and unwholesome, it's all arising in my mind. All the data of our senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, you know, feeling, is all being processed by mind. So mind is the key player in the wisdom path, right? In the mindful living path, in the Dharma path, we're doing a lot to transform the actions of our body, we're doing a lot to transform the actions of our speech, and we're doing a lot to transform thoughts, right? More wholesome thoughts, less unwholesome thoughts. In the wisdom path, we're not doing any of that. We're looking directly into the mind itself. Whose mind? Our own mind. So again, mindfulness, concentration, insight, basically the meditative path is the key path here, okay? And within the, you know, the Buddhist tradition, which is very broad, many traditions, many lineages, there are certain traditions in which this emphasis on, you know, on the Buddha's enlightenment as the basis for one's practice, this understanding that the fundamental experience of the Buddha in his enlightenment was this radical experience in which, you know, he realized that his identifications with his thoughts, with his feelings, with his perceptions, and with his self was a total misperception and was really the source of all human suffering. But it wasn't just a negation of that. He also experienced his true mind, his uncontaminated, undefiled, pure, beyond birth and death, et cetera, mind. That is the source of all good. And he said, all beings have this mind. It is our intrinsic mind. It is our true nature, right? So these paths, such as Zen, which is the Japanese of Chan or Tien, or in other traditions, the Great Perfection tradition, Mahamudra tradition, there are various traditions within Buddhism that sort of have their basis in this fundamental sense that enlightenment is not something we get to over successive kind of approximations, but is always imminent within us. And so as opposed to getting there, getting someplace, arriving at this state, The fundamental teaching is it's already here. So it's a matter of uncovering what's already here, which is a very different process. Right? So if it's already here, then I'm not endlessly going there, looking. I'm just mining my own treasure, which is right here, which is, again, the path. So I'll let the others share a little bit about the experience. So this retreat, and again, within these various lineages, many, going back to the Buddha, his teaching, but many, many great masters in all these traditions, right to the current time, have written teachings. So what I was following was a really wonderful practice poem by this late 15th, 16th century Chinese Chan teacher by the name of Han Shan. And that was the main focus. But the first day or so, I shared some kind of prerequisite teachings from a modern day. I've taught a little bit from him over the years, Chinese master, Chan master, called Shu Yun, Empty Cloud, who lived to be 120, and his life spanned from the mid 1850s right up until he lived into the 60s in China. And actually many people called him kind of a reincarnation of Han Shan, because Han Shan was a great reviver of Buddhism, especially Chan in the 16th century, and Shu Yun very much did that in the 20th century, 19th, 20th century. So I just took a very short teaching from Shu Yun. I want to share that because I think it's accessible to everyone. And then maybe I'll share a little bit from Han Shan before I call on the members. So he basically states there are four prerequisites to even beginning practice. Okay, and I'll just very, as I say, I gave commentary during the retreat. The first was a deep trust, confidence in the law of cause and effect. He kind of felt this is fundamental. If we don't understand that everything that is right now, whether it's within my own mind, my own life, the life of everyone else, society, planet, whatever, is occurring because of prior causes, right? Not to understand that is really to miss the whole operating principle of everything. So this is considered a law, the law of cause and effect, right? So it really is very radical, because one no longer goes, why is this happening? How could this happen? Blah, 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 blah. We just go, yeah, it's happening because of causes and conditions. No other reason. Doesn't mean we don't look into them, but we understand that nothing that's going on right now is going on like out of nowhere. Everything is going out of causes and conditions, many of them. And what they all are is hard to understand. Right, so like this past weekend, we just went through memorials for 9/11, right? But 9/11 didn't happen, it's out of nowhere, you see? It's like if you just take it, you have a very distorted way of looking at it. 9/11 didn't occur out of nowhere. There were lots of causes and conditions that created it. Our own country, our own foreign policy, our own interactions, the Middle East, their politics, their history, their culture, their religion, plus so many others, variables, all come together in that incident, right? If you don't understand that, you don't really, it's hard to act intelligently. The second one is strict observance of the precepts. Again, that's basically fundamental. We call those mindfulness trainings. That there's a sense, it's how important it is that one have an ethical basis to one's life. So one understands that in the actions of one's body, especially one's body and speech, one is no longer causing harm. And as one is actually contributing to the good, that's very stabilizing in life. The third, he calls them immovable faith or trust, confidence. You know, what does that mean? It's not like faith in faith-based traditions. It's very different. But it means if you're going to follow a path, you have to have confidence in the path, right? You have to, I mean, or else how can you follow it with any kind of surety? You know, if you're going to follow a spiritual path, if you're going to meditate, if you're going to practice mindfulness, you know, at whatever level one is practicing, one has to have confidence, right, that it works, that it will take me where I want to go, right? Or else, and, you know, one has to have confidence in the guide, in the teacher, you know. So without this strong, or the other way to put it, the less confidence, the less trust, probably the less we will walk the path with much less surety. Because there'll always be doubting, questioning, right? You see, and that, I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But if one wants to go somewhere, and one really wants to go there, then, you know, before one gets on whatever vehicle one's getting on, one has to trust that it's a worthy vehicle and it will take me where I want to go and that my companions on the voyage are all with me. Right? That's Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and teacher. I mean, if we don't, well, for those of you who've been there, you'll understand what that's like. So the more our confidence is strong, he says immovable, the stronger our practice will be. Probably the less confidence, less trust we have, the weaker our practice will be. And the fourth was choosing a Dharma door method of practice. And here quite simply means, you know, at a certain stage of our spiritual searching, we try this one, a little bit of this, we sample that, but if one really wants to, pursue a spiritual path, one has to choose a practice or a series of practices, right? You know, I mean, I think you all understand that, right? You know, when you're young and somebody says, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? I mean, my son used to say, you know, he wants to be a garbage man. Why? Because, you know, these guys who were driving around, these big trucks that made all these noise, to him was the most impressive thing going, you know? All right, now obviously as he grew up, he might have changed, and there's nothing against garbage men. You know, they do a great service to us, and we should be grateful to them. But in other words, many of us, you know, on our path, career path, life path, we didn't know what we were doing. Some of us may still not know what we're doing. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, it's like being in high school or going to college. You know, at a certain point, you have to decide, what is my major? Anybody ever, you know, like, you know, I have to major. I gotta make a choice. Career, I have to make a choice. You know, I can't keep sampling everything. I can't keep taking endless courses. You know, there are people like that, right? They stay, and I've met people, they're in their 30s or 40s. They're still going to college. You know, they're still, and they probably have, I've met people who have had 3 or 4 degrees. But they've never accomplished anything in any of them. So if we want to accomplish something, right, we have to choose a Dharma door. A Dharma door is, you know, how do I want to enter this path of transformation? So those are the prerequisites to even beginning a practice. But what I want to talk to you a little more today is, then he says, how to start the practice. And this was, I've taught this before, and this, I think this, but it's good for everybody to hear it again, because we forget. How to start the practice. And Xu Yun said, the simplest way, as a prerequisite, is to make the distinguishment between host and guest. Key, you know, you don't have to, you know, be an advanced Dharma practitioner to get this one, okay? And for all those of you who are familiar, even we're on retreat, please listen to it again. And basically, in his talk, Xu Yun quoted Kaundinya, and this is a person in the Sarangama Sutra, one of the great Buddhist sutras. He mentioned the words, he said, host and guest. This is where beginners shouldn't begin their practice. So anybody here who thinks they're a beginner, even if they think you're advanced, we're all probably still beginners. And so he quotes the sutra. He quotes Kaundinya. It's very simple. A traveler who stops at an inn may stay overnight or get something to eat. When they are finished or rested, they pack up and continue their journey. But they don't have time to stay longer. If he was the host, if this person was the host, man or woman, then they wouldn't be going on, right? The one who does not stay, he's just defining terms. The one who does not stay is called the guest. The one who stays is the host. See how simple this is? Okay, so he's distinguishing a host from guest and uses an example that we all understand. And then he goes on to comment. Host and guest refer to illusory, guest refers to illusory thoughts, while host refers to self-nature. The permanent host does not follow the guest in the guest's comings and goings. And Xu Yun says, this illustrates that permanent self-nature does not follow illusory thoughts in their fleeting rise and fall. Okay? So this is fundamental. He called this a prerequisite for practice. We have a mind, don't we? And if we have some self-awareness, we've done some meditation, we've done some observation, we realize what? What endlessly comes and goes? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, right? Endlessly coming and going. How many thoughts, feelings, perceptions have come and gone in your mind since you woke up this morning? How many came and went during your meditation? And that's it, endlessly coming and going. No permanence, no substance, no solidity. Is that true? Just take a moment, just reflect on that. Is that true? Ask yourself. Is it true that all my thoughts, all my perceptions, all my stories that have endlessly arisen in my life from time immemorial, all have that, the reality of that they're just guests? They just come and go. Every mind state you've ever had came and went. Please take a moment, just close your eyes, just reflect. Is that true? In my own mind, do I know what the guests are? Is that true? It all just comes and goes. Things appear and disappear. Every day, new stories on the news, new stories with everybody else, every time, and nonstop, right? Is that true? My feelings come and go. Everything just comes and goes, especially my thoughts, things that appear in my mind. Right? When guests come into our home, we make them, they're guests, right? But when it's time for them to leave, we don't run after them, do we? We don't say, you know, I want to go with you wherever you're going, right? We don't. We stay where? We stay home. Whether the guests have just dropped by for a few hours or whether they've stayed a few days, the nature of guests is they go. And the nature of host is the host stays. So he says the one that stays, which means the one who stays in our own mind, is our own self-nature, our own true nature. Because if I ask you, with all the comings and goings of your illusory thoughts for decades, you're still here, aren't you? In this moment, you are still here. Is that true? Ask yourself that. So there is something that stays. And there is something that can look back on all this illusory, this and that, all the comings and goings of life, and be very aware of it. There is a host. Is that clear? There is something that is here right now that, with all that ups and downs and comings and goings and good times and bad times and positive emotions and afflictive emotions and wholesome mind states and unwholesome mind states and all the activity of the mind, right? There is something that is right here now, aware, present, and is totally capable of watching the illusory guests in this moment, right? Like right now, if you're listening to this talk, this is an illusory talk. Because it has no permanence, right? It's going to be gone. I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be gone from your consciousness. I'm going to be gone, right? This whole experience is a guest. All your feelings right now are guests. But there is something that stays. So the emphasis, you see, up to now, with our mindful living path and our Dharma path, we have been exploring and understanding the guests, right? And we've been working very hard to treat our guests better, right? Not struggle with them, not fight with them, be more understanding of our guests, right? And we've also been working hard, you know, to have nicer guests. More, you know, to be, you know, I want to have different guests in my mind. If I'm going to have thoughts, mind states, I want nicer ones. Ones that feel better, right? So we've been working not only very hard to change our relationship, we've actually been working very hard to change the quality of the guests. So that's the practice very much in the mindful living path and the Dharma path. Okay. At this stage of practice, the wisdom practice level, we're no longer, you know, that was the prerequisite. We're no longer interested in the guests at all. We're interested in the host. What is the host? It's really fundamentally, who am I? What is the nature of mind? Right? What's really going on in here? And there is something that stays. What is that? Right? Because it has a very strong quality, you know, if we can begin to see it. Most people can't see it because they're always engaged in following and being led around by the nose, by the who? By the guests. Totally consumed by the guests. Right? We've never even been aware that there's a host here. The host is the one to stay. Well, if you think about it, since I understand that all the guests come and go, all the thoughts come and go, all the mind states come and go, I'd really want to be attentive to that which stays, because that's the one I wake up with every morning. That's the one who I go through my life with, the one who stays. And if I never focus on that because I'm so consumed and obsessed by all the guests, that really are just coming and going, I will never understand who and what I really am, and never have an understanding of the true nature of our mind, which according to the Buddha and the Masters is pure, undefiled, the basis of everything wholesome, beyond birth and death. I mean, it's quite something. But if I'm always, you know, looking out there, I'll never experience that, will I? So this distinction between hosts and guests is something that everybody on this call, on this talk, can understand and begin to integrate a little bit into your life, into your understanding, because it gives you, you know, again, if you have a guest that's an unwelcome guest, a little obnoxious guest, right? I'm sure we've all had those people in our home as guests. Knowing that they're not going to stay is a very different experience than having an obnoxious, unwanted guest who you believe is going to stay forever in your house and you're going to have to live with them, right? Can you kind of feel the difference? But unfortunately, we treat our guests as if, you know, oh, they're going to be here forever. I got to do something right now, right? I got to react right now. No, relax. They're going to go. Just let them be. They'll go. Don't engage, don't follow, don't struggle with. They'll go. Because that is the nature of what? That is the nature of guests. They're the ones that come and go. I want to know that I'm the host. Right? Anybody ever, you know, been a hostess or a host in a, you know, restaurant or an, you know, it's like, right? What do you know? You have to put up with all kinds of people, don't you? Right? But you do it. Why? Because, you know, it's, you know, they're only here for a little bit. You know, I can put up with them. I don't need to get bent out of shape. I don't have to take it personally. I don't have to engage. Right? But we don't know that. We engage, we engage, we engage, we engage. And we create affliction for ourselves and others. So that was the kind of preliminary. And then just a quick thing from Hanshan, just to give you a sense of how it works at the wisdom level for those who aren't familiar. So this is one of Hanshan's maxims. He said, the unstoppable stream of ego's conscious thoughts cannot stay still long enough to comprehend the truth. Is that true? Have you ever noticed that there seems to be an unstoppable amount of thoughts just coming and going, and it's hard for them to even stay long enough to even understand what's going on? Yet people are always trying to think up a barrier to the flow to use thoughts to stop thinking. Sound familiar to anybody? So there is this flow of thought, and we're always trying to mess with it. We're always trying to figure it out. We're trying to stop it. We're always, right, trying to manipulate the flow of thoughts. And he said the main thing we do is to use thoughts to stop thinking. Thoughts are like wildcats. We would never use one wildcat to tame another. Okay? Interesting analogy. Thoughts are like wildcats. If you had a wild cat, you know, running around in your house, you know, the answer wouldn't be to bring another wild cat in to get rid of it. Because then you'd have what? Two wild cats. And when you have two wild cats, the intensity could grow quite exponentially, okay? How then do we enter the state of non-thought? We understand the non-substantial nature of both the one who is thinking and the thought itself. This is a very key focus of wisdom meditation. It's no longer manipulating anything, controlling anything. It's we want to understand, what is the nature of the ego? What is the nature of the self? What is the true nature of a thought? Well, since self and ego and thoughts are all arising into my mind, that's where I'm looking. Again, it is understanding that we seek, not control and manipulation. We want to come to the understanding that in reality, there is not even a single tiny thought of a thought or a thinker or a thinker either. Anything in the sense that anything is real, solid, substantial. When we bear witness to this reality, the reality of our own minds, our own testimony, testimonies mean our own experience. Interesting word, we don't talk in Buddhism, testimony. Our own testimony liberates us from the bondage of thoughts and from the bondage of thoughts of having no thoughts. Right? Many of us live in the bondage of, I just don't have these thoughts, then I will be fine and everything will be good. But in the wisdom level, we want to, when we understand the nature of thoughts, we no longer have to stop anything because we understand the nature of everything. And one of the things that, you know, we say, we understand they're just guess. Right? They don't live here. I live here. Right? And even if the guests are acting up a little bit, my job is to stay calm, present, open, understanding, compassionate. That's my job. Why? I'm the host. I understand my relationship to the guests. If you don't understand your relationship to your guest, you're lost. What are you lost at? In endlessly engaging with the guests. And if you've ever been doing that for the last decades of your life, you know it never ends, does it? It never ends, that engagement. And when you engage with the guests, then you're going for a ride. And who's in control? The guests. And when we engage with our thoughts, when we engage with our emotions, when we engage with our perceptions, especially the afflictive ones, and just struggle with them, go with them, follow them, we're lost in the world of the guest. And all the guests are different. We have wholesome guests and unwholesome guests. Intelligent guests, stupid guests, spiritual guests, totally worldly guests, right? Always coming and going. But if we don't know who I am as the host, very easy to get lost. So that's by way of background. Now I'd like to call on, I believe there are three people in the hall. If you could just come up and just sit kind of up here on the dais. And then Carol, who's in Naples, is on. And just, maybe for 5 minutes or so, just each of you just share your experience of being on this past. Yeah, just you can just kind of sit. Yeah. Just get comfortable. You want to begin, Mitch?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm Mitch.
And you're from?
Within St. Petersburg, I practice with the St. Petersburg Sangha as well as here in Tampa.
There we go. How's that? Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Mitch. I live in St. Petersburg and part of the St. Petersburg Sangha as well as practice it here in Tampa. Been a member about 5-6 years now. And this retreat really helped me deepen my practice in a number of ways. I've been on a few wisdom retreats before. And as Fred shared, in the retreats were often looking at our minds, our thoughts, investigating who is Mitch, who am I that is thinking these thoughts, and where did these thoughts come from, where did they go. And while I've practiced with that in the past, I've often found it somewhat constrictive, almost claustrophobic at times, to do that for long periods. And one of the practices we worked with on this retreat was, in addition to the guest and host, working with the space around us and practicing and recognizing in the room we might have been sitting in, how the clutter could easily be removed if we wanted to, whether it's the clutter on the floor, the papers, or whether it was the furniture. And when we walked outside, how much space there was. And practicing with that really created a freedom and a much more open feeling for me as I started to do more of the investigation into myself. And I really felt like it was a nice complement to the practice I was already working with. So I felt, you know, it was progress on my developmental path. The second area where I really felt I had a breakthrough was in this era, practice of looking at the guest and host and noticing my thoughts much more quickly. There was an experience I had in the retreat where I was feeling some frustration and afflictive emotion because a loved one is experiencing a big challenge. And I was thinking to myself, well, maybe there was an opportunity to deal with it a year or so ago when it was a small problem and now it's a big problem. So that was the thought that was arising, I guess a little bit of self-righteous indignation behind that. And then working with this practice of guest and host, I realized, you know, that's just a thought that came up. I let it go. And all of a sudden, that feeling and experience of my self-nature brought me to a place of feeling, how do I want to be of benefit? And not in a way where I got into thinking about the specifics of how I wanted to be a benefit, but really more that feeling of love and compassion. And it just created also a lot of space and was very moving, almost brought me to tears, without thoughts coming in and flooding the picture. And so as I thought about the guest and host, I realized whenever I stay at an Airbnb or a hotel, I'm always asking for an extended checkout, and the guests in my inn are not going to get an extended checkout. They're, you know, they'll be escorted out when they start disturbing the neighbors. So it's really a helpful practice to constantly be looking at that. And I think lastly, the thing that was really beneficial for me, and maybe it's related to the Dharma doors, I'd be curious, Fred, for your thoughts, but understanding the aspiration for my practice. We worked with that a little bit as well, and Fred asked, what's the energy you want to bring to your practice? And I think there was a maxim, or maybe it was a Fredism, which was, your aspiration is the cause for the effect that you want to realize. And so it really made me take a look again, not only at my aspiration in my life of how I want to show up with peace and equanimity and love and being the calm one in the boat when it's needed, but also what aspiration and intention do I have for my practice when I sit? Because sometimes when I'm sitting, I clutter my practice with too much, you know, my breathing, then my bodhisattva vows, and then the four mind turnings, or, you know, the five remembrances. And it's like, I'm doing too much sometimes. And maybe I need to just take a step back, create more space and say, what's my intention or aspiration for, as I'm sitting today, based on what's happening in my life. So that was a bit of a light bulb that went off for me too. So.
I feel very fortunate that I go on a lot of retreats, and I go on Mindful Living Path retreats, you know, weekend retreats, 3-day retreats, because I need to, you know, I need to relax, stabilize my mind, meditate, practice mindful living, and do some healing and transforming at the foundation level. And I continue to need that. And I do that. It's kind of like when we lived in California and we'd have to take care of the foundation so the house wouldn't fall off in an earthquake. And we had to, you know, take care of the foundation work. And so I know that I need foundation work. I also go on Dharma Path retreats. I love Buddhism. I love all the different aspects. And they're just, you know, yeah, there are 84,000 Dharma doors, they say. But there are just many ways that help me see Buddhism, see the practice from a little bit different angle. So I just keep going to Dharma Path retreats because they help me practice and help my day to day and help my ongoing practice and understanding. So they're very useful. And then once a year, I try to go on a Wisdom Path retreat and have for a number of years for a week. And so I was unable to go on the Wisdom Path retreat we had here in June. So I was really happy that Fred decided to do another one, 5 days. And so that's great. And I was looking forward to coming to Great Cloud, staying in it, but it turned circumstances, changing world that we live in. So I did a Wisdom Path retreat online. And it's very interesting because, you know, yeah, I'd rather be up in the mountains on the side of a mountain doing a wisdom retreat or in a brand new building over here that this, as a community we've been building for so long. But it really didn't matter that I was on Zoom and a computer because, as Fred said, the emphasis was looking this way instead of that way. It really wasn't about where I was in the circumstances. It was taking days to meditate and focus on meditating. It took me about 3 days to really settle my mind. I mean, that's typical. Sometimes it's faster, but the longer retreats have that effect, you know, and it's the old story of the sediment in the water. It settles and then the water's clear. Sitting for, you know, 4 different meditation sessions a day, different times, it just, there's an accumulative effect. So about day 3, you know, I was like, oh yeah, I had forgotten, you know, I've forgotten what this like, as I was able to calm enough to really, you know, focus back in here, to look at thoughts, to look at the, you know, the thoughts coming, you know, you know, ask, are they real? Where do they come? Where do they go? You know, and who is thinking? And is there a self? There's a number of questions that we use in the different wisdom traditions, which I recall Brian saying, because Brian helped lead this retreat in a really wonderful way. He's sitting right in front of me. He said, it's the looking that's so important, the questioning, the looking. And I found that to be true. Bottom line, the retreat just was like turning on the lights for me again, being grimy and dirty and sweaty and smelly after working outside, being able to take a shower, you know, or dive in the pool and it's clean and cool and, you know, open and wonderful. That's what a wisdom retreat is for me. Now I take with me this one, something new, which is, yeah, I've got a Dharma door and keep practicing, because as many wisdom retreats as I've been on for as many years, I keep forgetting. I practice for a while and I forget, you know, and then I'm just about sitting there calming and I'm not doing the looking and opening and the incredible results that seems to bring in my life. And so I know what to do and I have a commitment to keep practicing. I bring that out of the retreat and, you know, host and guest is so wonderful. Last night at 10 p.m. I was going, oh no, I can't talk tomorrow. I don't know what to say. I can't. It went blah, 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 blah. You know, all this stuff. And, you know, all I had to do is go, guess. I was playing with the guests. I was talking with the guests. I was, and here's the key thing. I was identifying with the guests. I was the guests with all the doubt and negative self-talk and negative, you know, and then step back. I'm not. So thank you, Fred, for a wonderful retreat. And Brian.
So we'll pass it on to Ned, and then we'll, Carol.
Thanks.
Betsy lives here. Oh.
So Betsy lives here in Tampa, Tampa native, and you've been a member here how many years?
10, 11
years. And now we have Ned.
Thanks, Fred. I'm borrowing your timepiece here a little bit. Thanks. Okay, good. I think what I want to talk about first is the...
Why don't you introduce yourself? You're Ned, and you live in...
I'm sorry. And I live in Clearwater. And I began all this as a book Buddhist for decades. And... I was pretty sure that I could think my way into some sort of glimpse of awakening. And the next book or the next workshop or PowerPoint would clear all this up for me. So I want to talk about the third prerequisite that Fred mentioned about this practice, about this path, about what we need. And it was the subject of confidence and trust and faith. And what we've been talking a lot about the sort of mind that never stops, what I think of as a sort of unconscious flow of thoughts that run through my head and drive me a little bit nuts all the time. And we'll talk about that in a second, and that's what we did on the retreat. But I realized that what I think of as the sort of MC squared mind, the intentional gift of the human race about conscious thought, which was so helpful to me in the first two paths of Buddhism to understand the Dharma and myself, was getting in the way, and it's really slowed me down, because I sort of came out in Catholicism what we used to call a smorgasbord spirituality, which was we would take what we needed and what we believed in, and the rest of it we would sort of put on the side. So it was like eating around the broccoli, and so what was happening, so I come to the wisdom path, which for me is mystery. And I couldn't think my way through it. And so what I would do is I'd be agnostic and I'd say, well, I'll put this on the shelf for later. And when I find the right book, I'll figure it out. Or I couldn't even imagine my way into interbeing and non-self, for example. Or my ability to do this, do I really have the chops for this? And this is important because what I noticed is it really slowed me down. This sort of not knowing and not trusting, it was like dragging an anchor through this path. And I made progress, but I'm urging all of us to sort of think at some point, so what happened on this? Really as a result of that reading that Fred made, is that I made a decision that it was high time to get over myself and to accept all of it. And it was like, why not? There was something very sweet about that surrender to not knowing. And it's like, Ned, you got a better idea, you know? So anyway, there's that. In terms of, and for an old book Buddhist, I want to tell you, the wisdom path is a whole new experience, the retreat. So for example, for a guy who's read maybe 800 million books, 8 pages, reading 8 pages in 5 days, or 1.6 pages a day, approximately, is not an old book Buddhist idea of a wild vacation. I mean, it just isn't, right? It's like, so you talk about putting thinking aside and going inside, putting thought aside and going into experience. It was absolutely wonderful. So two or three things, not surprising, and Brian was so helpful to me, and always has been, as we work through how to meditate in this way, the little stuff. So for example, I realize that for me to get present off the cushion, I need not to just slow down, I need to stop. Not for long, a moment, but I have to come full stop. Anyway. And another one was that I can't do this, I can't stop all that flow of thoughts ever, but I can't even address them more than one at a time. I have to do this simply. I was reminded again in this retreat, again, it seems so obvious, how the frequency of my meditation has some geometric impact on the ease of meditating and the depth of my meditation. So it's like, wow. And that is carried overward. I also need to acknowledge, it took Betsy 3 days, and it took me, I'm sure, more than that, to quiet my mind and to settle in. And finally, so I do what I do. I made lists. I cataloged about 15 or 16 of my recurring themes. And even though, I've forgotten, Fred, how it goes, but the wonderful Chinese Zen master said, you know, you're supposed to keep your mind constantly aware of the first thought that enters. I'm so not there. I just picked the top three of my 18. And so, for example, they are my to-do list, which runs my life, my need to please others, the next talk I was going to give, right? And so I'm just watching those. One last thing about this that I noticed was how, when I did all this and I looked at all of these things I think about all the time that don't amount to a hill of beans, and I'm going, I was struck with the waste of my time, the waste of a life doing that. And also, it is the most boring way. So, you know, the National Science Foundation, assuming we'd have at least 12,000 thoughts a day, of which 95% are exactly like yesterday's thoughts. And that was true for me. This was the most boring way to spend a life. And it's like, oh my God. So two biggies for me. Okay, thank you, Bill. Bill is our assistant softball coach. This is gonna be really quick. The two biggest takeaways for me were these. I learned that access to my mind with ease is available to me constantly, in between thoughts, and not just restricted to looking at my mind, only doing formal meditation. And finally, that my formal meditations have been more continuous since the retreat, and the experience of more sustained and deeper sitting has been an incredible source of peace and freedom for me. Thank you, my dear teacher.
Possible to I can't hear Fred, so I'm assuming that it's time to start talking. Yes, okay. I'm Carol Green. I live in Naples. I have been a member of FCM for 8 years. I'm a loyal member of the Naples Sangha, as well as, of course, the larger Sangha. I'm retired from the newspaper business, and so I come to you this morning having had a lucid dream of words tumbling down the mountainside, just a stream of words and letters upside down, sideways, going in a big circle, down, down the mountainside, words and letters endlessly, endlessly, endlessly. And that's what I do. The joke that I have for years told about myself is that when it comes to doing math, to me, numerals are spelled out. And so the number 5 is not a numeral. It is F-I-V-E. So it's just words. And of course, I'm now in the exploration of the Dharma, coming to understand that words are thoughts and perceptions. And so the endless stream of words meets the Buddha. And in the most recent wisdom retreat, which is the second, I believe, wisdom retreat that I've attended, maybe third, I'm not sure, words met Dharma. And so, first of all, I'd like to share with you the small group discussion experience that I had with Fred, where I am trying to explain that, yes, I'm so excited. I have had this glimpse of openness leading to connection and this expansive feeling of openness. It was a glimpse. It was a tiny glimmer. And maybe it was this, or maybe it was because of that. I don't know. And Fred said, stop. And the words continued to flow out of me. I didn't hear him the first time. And he said, stop. What is it that you said? And I said, well, I said it was this or that. I said, no, what are those 3 words that you said? And I said, they were, I don't know. And he said, that's your mantra. What does a person who is carried away on a flood of words do when her teacher says, shut up? And so I did. I shut up, well, to the best of my ability. But then when I went back through my notes, I went, oh, when the emperor asked Bodhidharma if he was a holy man, Bodhidharma said, I don't know. And left, just walked off. And so that's a very worthy mantra. And so I'm going to keep the image of this worthless, endless flow of words and letters rolling down the mountainside of my dream this morning in front of me and try to remember to watch them go by instead of trying to climb on board, because this endless flow of words and letters are guests. They're just guests. So big one. Thank you, Fred. I have a mantra, shut up.
Just for the record, I didn't actually say shut up. So.
Oh, you didn't, but I got it.
But actually, Zen is very direct, so perhaps you're absolutely right. So thank you, all 4 of you. It's really been wonderful to hear. Again, you know, as the teacher, I have a certain way of presenting, but I think it's very important that people in our community hear from peers, just like us, who are going through their own experiences, and to, I think in a certain way that has a lot of validity. So let me just, we really don't have time for questions, it's almost time to end. So let me just just take off from what Carol said about, and I won't go into the anecdote between Bodhidharma, who brought what became Chan or Zan, Chan or Zen, to China. So when the emperor asked him, I mean, after this is Bodhidharma basically refuting every idea that the emperor, who was a very devout Buddhist, had about his sacredness or his holiness and all the good works he was doing, and trying to kind of get a handle on Bodhidharma and couldn't get a handle. And so finally he says, "Who are you?" And Bodhidharma says, "I don't know." Please, he knew who he was. But he knew that who he was beyond labels. Could not be pigeonholed into words. Because we all know that. When we're having a real experience, it's beyond words. Even whatever the experience is, eating a certain food or enjoying something or hating something, you know, it's an experience, right? And then we take that very alive experience and we parse it into words, and we do to just explain it to somebody else. But to think that the words, my explanation of the experience, is the same of the direct experience I had is not true, and we all know that. So when Bodhidharma said to the emperor, "I don't know," he was really saying, "I just am. You know, I'm not going to give you words. I'm not going to give you a name." Because if he gave him a name, you know, "My name is Bodhidharma, and I'm a monk from India," right away the emperor would put him in a pigeonhole. "Oh, now I know who you are. I got you," you see? And we're always putting all our experiences into files. We have these endless files in our mind, and everything we experience, we're putting into a file. And the wisdom path invites us to stop doing that. To get rid of our files and just experience life directly, people directly, you know, and that's life. So I don't know is a very wonderful practice. So thank you for listening. Sorry we didn't have any questions, but I think everything has been said. So thank you all for coming this morning.